Hi, this is Elizabeth Miles, and you're listening to The Sirens of Audio.
Oh, yes, quite so. Yes, of course, I do know the medium.
Hey, audiophiles, you are listening to The Sirens of Audio, the podcast that explores Doctor Who in the audio medium. It's great to be here. My name is Dwayne, I'm your host, and with me is...
It's Philip. G'day, audiophiles. Good to be here.
It's good to have you here too, Philip. Today's going to be a very special episode because we have had the privilege recently of speaking with the lovely Sophie Aldred, and we're going to be sharing that interview very shortly. How was that experience for you?
It was very special. I think Sophie has a special place. I was quite young still, well, teenager, when she was playing Ace, and she was one of those strong, influential characters. She made more sense in terms of who she was than who'd been there before. I've always loved the companions, and Mel and Perry had been around for a couple of years. I liked them fine, but Ace was a character who was a kid. She was sort of my age and stage, and so I could really relate to her. And so I think she played a special place in terms of my young adulthood. Well, I guess I was still a teenager then. Just loved her performance, and also just the fact that Doctor Who seemed to be growing up with her. You had a companion with a character arc, you had a companion who drove the plot forward. And just talking with her, she's just such a lovely person. So, it's been a blast.
She is. She absolutely is. But before we get to that and get too much further, I see a rabbit hole up ahead, Philip.
Excellent. Here we go. Love a hole.
All right. So, now that we're in this rabbit hole, it's not going to be anything too controversial, and you've already touched on some of the things that I want to discuss with you, but I just want to get... Well, you've already spoken about some of your memories of Sophie Aldred, and I'm thinking specifically about some memories of Ace. So, Ace was a character who appeared in the first series of Doctor Who that I was eagerly anticipating and recording off the television. So, Dragonfire came along, and there was Sophie Aldred, someone who was closer to my age than previous companions had been. So, there was a bit more relatability there. And it was great to have that character, and those final two seasons of Classic Who were quite sensational, and it still baffles me to this day as to why it didn't continue, because season 26 had, if you look at season 24 and how much had changed in that 2 years to season 26, I just don't understand why they weren't making it. It just seems to me like, well, it's probably been discussed and talked about in fandom for years, but it seemed like the BBC wasn't even watching the show anymore.
Yeah, I think that's definitely the case. I think they knew that. I mean, Sophie, people here mentioned it soon, the fact that they had actually a lot of freedom because no one was caring. Now my memory is, my memory might be faulty, but my memory is season 24 and 25 were both shown back to back. And so my memory is that we had a long gap waiting for Sylvester to come. And then when he did come, they did all of 24 than 25. And so I remember going from Dragonfire straight into Revelation of the Daleks. And that was Remembrance of the Daleks, thank you. Good correcting. And that just blew me away. That show just was a turning point in terms of absolute classic that just nailed everything right. It was period BBC, it was 60s, it was an amazing cast. Sylvester and Sophie just hit their parts out of the park, the special effects, the explosions. That was a turning point in terms of, yes, Doctor Who had turned unbelievably good. So there'd been a while when I don't think I was embarrassed to watch it, but certainly I didn't have quite the same enthusiasm for a couple of years. But with Remembrance of the Daleks, my entire attitude towards the show changed. And you're right, those next two seasons, Yeah, unbelievable.
Apart from the Happiness Patrol, I was a little bit embarrassed by that, but apart from, and but now I've come to appreciate it a lot more than I did at the time. But as a teenager, I thought, oh, it's gone back to Delta and the Bannerman, which is now my favourite story of season 24. But yeah, if my memory serves me correctly, they showed season 24 and then Remembrance of the Daleks, and that's it. And then they brought it back, starting with Remembrance again, and then went into 25.
You know what? That could be right. Yes.
Does that ring a bell?
That does ring a bell. I do remember going straight into the Dalek show, though, and just that being a high point, and that would make sense. It went like that.
They screened that season in the wrong order in Australia, too. So, Greatest Show in the Galaxy came second, then Silver Nemesis, then Happiness Patrol, whereas I think it was Happiness Patrol was supposed to be number two and Greatest Show was supposed to be the fourth story in that season. So they showed that in the wrong order. I'll never forget that because I had my tapes lined up and that was the order they were always in.
Threw you out totally. You're saying about Happiness Patrol, about you just not liking it back then. The reason why I liked it was my parents rarely watched anything with me. But I do remember my mother being in the room when I was watching the episode of Happiness Patrol, and she looked up and realised, she said, they're taking off Margaret Thatcher. My mother loathed Margaret Thatcher, and she realised what was going on, and she actually paid attention to an episode because she recognised what was going on. I was a bit naive to it all still, but my mother really hit a point for her in terms of realising the satire.
Yeah. So how old was I in 1989, 1990? 16, 17? So I was, my teenage eyes were sort of turning towards Ace at the time, and I was enjoying a companion of the Doctor for completely new reasons. That was another aspect of that era that I really loved. But then the show finished. But Sophie didn't stop having involvement with the Doctor Who universe, because obviously in the Wilderness years we had all those different fan productions with Bill Baggs sort of pioneering the different videos. I think the first one Sophie was in was called More Than a Messiah. She was in that one, and then later in the 90s went on to star in lots of different audios produced by Bill Baggs. So did you get into those BBV audios at all, Philip?
I did listen to them at the time, but I wasn't hugely into them. Hmm. I think I was at that stage, I was probably early 20s, and I hadn't really quite come back. So I sort of, when the show ended, I sort of took a bit of a step back. I think I would have kept getting the Doctor Who magazine, and certainly Ace was still in all the comics for a long time after that. But certainly, aside from getting the magazine, I wasn't hugely into too much stuff. It was a Doctor Who magazine with Louise Jamison, with Leela on the cover, and I would have been probably 26 or 27 at that point. And that's when I sort of came back with a bit of a vengeance, having had about 5-6 years off.
And of course, before the audios for BBV, Ace, the character, had appeared with a massive arc in the Virgin New Adventures. Were you into those as well? I must say that personally, I wasn't. I read a few of them and I just couldn't ever get into them. What about yourself?
No, I never got the New Adventures or the Past Doctors BBC stuff. I wasn't into any of that particularly.
Was there any reason? Did you give any of them a go?
I think, once again, I was just the wrong age when they came out. Had I gone off Doctor Who? I don't think I hadn't gone off Doctor Who, but I certainly wasn't prepared at that stage to branch out. So the TV shows I had as many videos I could possibly have. I was still watching them. I had a lot of audio. I'd recorded a lot onto tape off my television set. So I had lots of Doctor Who shows on tape more than video, because we were a bit late getting a video recorder. And I just wasn't particularly interested in going... It was before the whole canon debate, but I guess in my mind it wasn't canon.
Right.
So I just didn't get into them. I mean, I've gone back now and read more, and Big Finish have done a lot of episodes,
adaptations,
yeah. And I've actually really enjoyed them. So yeah. I think I would have enjoyed them. I just think I was at the wrong age and stage in life. I was into dating at that stage and I was doing music and university and other things, and it just wasn't quite what I was into. I kind of left the club behind. So, when I was all through school, I was going to events that the club were doing. But when I left school, I didn't particularly have any strong friendships or relationships with anyone in the club at that stage. And then when I came back later, that's when things changed in terms of the Doctor Who Club of Australia.
Yeah, it was a similar period kind of thing for me too during the 90s. Early 90s, I was married, so I was focused on that, and I was focused on starting a couple of businesses. I'd moved interstate, so yeah, I'd moved well away from the Sydney-based club. And I kind of just, drifted away from it as well. And like you said, I've gone back and I'm actually at the moment currently reading Lungbarrow, which I'm almost halfway through at the moment. I've never read it before. Mark Platt, always highly regarded in fandom. A lot of people say, why didn't Big Finish do that? Well, if you read the book, you'll get a bit of an understanding why Big Finish didn't try and tackle that one. It's quite, it's in typical complex Mark Platt style. Well, the reason I am reading that and I'm starting to go back into the New Adventures now is because there are quite a lot of elements that Big Finish use in their plays that have been drawn from those books, like Romana returning from East Base, for instance. It's never explained how that happened in Big Finish. She just turns up on Gallifrey. So if you're not a reader of the books, you're not going to know how Romana came back, and that's in one of the New Adventures. The events of Lungbarrow are interesting. Ace hasn't made a big appearance yet. I'm almost halfway through the book, but I know she's in it because she's in there as the character called Dorothy. So Dorothy is also a name that she started using all of a sudden in Big Finish as well. And I thought, why is she using the name Dorothy? But it was already something that was established in the books. So, that's why I'm taking a little trip back now and starting to read some more New Adventures. I've got them all, but I just haven't read them all. So, it's been quite enjoyable, actually, to go back and dip into that. What about some of her arcs and situations that she's been placed in during Big Finish? What are some of your standout memories of that?
Well, I must admit, I love her and Benny Summerfield together. I think when her, Benny, and the Doctor are doing their threesome acts in the couple orders they have, it's really a standout because they really have to try to make all three into major characters. Because, the Doctor always takes a bit of a backseat with Ace anyhow and lets her run stuff. And then with Benny having her own range, it meant that they really had to make the three of them stand out. So the couple of audios I really enjoy with all of them together.
There's only three of them, I think.
Yes. They
did Love and War plus the Dark Flame plus Shadow of the Scourge. I think that's the only three.
And Shadow of the Scourge, I adore. I think it's such a fun, exciting. I love that one.
The Dark Flame, however.
Yes, it has some problems. there's the New Adventures of Bernie Summerfield, which brings back Ace as well.
And of the course, Seventh Doctor, of course.
In the couple of box sets. Yeah. So they're not bad, too. I think her and Hex work brilliantly well together. I mean, it's interesting that they've paired her and Mel together for the last couple of trilogies. And it's been nice having...
I think that's worked well.
It has worked very well. So I was surprised how well that worked. But I think Big Finish rescued Mel so much anyhow.
Yeah, of course.
What do you think about some of her Big Finish stuff?
I really loved the dynamic of the Seventh Doctor, Ace and Hex. I thought that was really good. They're probably my favourite team featuring the Seventh Doctor and Ace. Although the only problem is the story arc of Hex became quite complicated, quite convoluted towards the end. So I found myself a little bit out of the loop. I was listening to stories really quickly, not taking the detail of them in so much, and then getting to another Hex story and going, okay, what's happened here? So that's a bit of a trap towards the end of the Hex story arc. But yeah, those early ones in particular, I really, really enjoy. Plus, Hex is a good character in terms of Big Finish, because he has a big crossover between the Sixth and Seventh Doctors. And he's got a close connection with Evelyn as well, because of the involvement that Evelyn, the close relationship that Evelyn had with Hex's mother, which we don't know at first. That took a while to come out, but when it did, I thought that was really nice too. So yeah, that combination with Ace and Hex, I always thought something might happen. There's always that kind of simmering romance potential there, but it never really happened. It was always more like a brother and sister type thing. So, which is what a lot of people prefer. And I'm probably one of them. I'm probably one of those ones who prefer romance to be in some other show, if you want to watch something like that, rather than Doctor Who. But, I've really enjoyed everything that she's done, particularly at the Hex team. So let's get into the interview with Sophie. But before we do, we mentioned the Fearmonger, her first Big Finish story with the Seventh Doctor. So let's have a listen to a trailer for that right now, and we'll come back with Sophie Aldred.
People these days are afraid. Afraid of the lawless gangs and the drugs and violence they bring into our cities.
Something's got to be done. Something's got to be done.
Afraid to speak simple truths for fear of being labelled politically incorrect or worse.
He's called the Doctor.
So what's this creature you were talking about? The Fearmonger?
We know what it does and how it does it, but I'm afraid there's no easy label for what it is.
I've been aware of him for some years now.
What kind of moron are you?
The kind who knows what to look for.
Intelligence Division, Department
C-19. And we're back with another hour of the Mick Thompson Show, home of the real story. All the little things the uni-loonies and greasy PC freaks don't want you to hear.
Oh, yeah. We know all about the monsters.
I don't think he'll be getting a friendly reception wherever he goes next.
But we know what the problems are, and we know who they are.
Many would say that the first of the modern companions was Ace. In the companion Ace, we suddenly had a real person with a backstory and a character arc. Ace was wonderfully played by Sophie Aldred, and we welcome her here. So, Sophie, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
How have you been over there? Where are you in? Are you in London or outside of?
I'm just outside London, sort of to the northwest of London, right on the edge of the countryside. So actually, I've been incredibly grateful for where we are situated. We look over fields and we can get out for nice walks, and it's actually been absolutely fine. So I'm very
grateful.
You stay
safe and well.
Yes. I think my son and I had it very early on, sort of before lockdown this time last year. But we don't really know, because people weren't quite sure then what it was. But otherwise, we've been very well, thank goodness. And my extended family have too, which is great. My elderly parents are fine, so all is well. And I'm just sort of, my heart goes out to those people who, you know, who have not had such a good time as I have, and who may be on their own. And another thing is, I'm with my husband, and most of the time been with our two sons, so that's been fantastic. But I know not everybody's as fortunate, so thinking of everybody.
Yep. Have you been able to keep working okay with the COVID?
Well, very early on, I thought, how am I going to do this? And I bought myself, I thought, well, it's not going to last for long, but anyway. And I bought myself a microphone, and we've got this airing cupboard in our bathroom, which is kind of full. It's very small, a little cupboard. It's full of towels and sheets. And I've always done sort of test recordings in there on my phone. And people have said, oh, you've got a really good sound in there for recording. So I thought, you know what? So I made myself a little studio in there amongst the towels and the sheets and the pillowcases. And in fact, just after I speak to you, I'm diving back in there to do an audiobook. So I have been able to work a bit on and off, which has been a relief. And then sometimes, actually, when the lockdowns lifted, I was able to go to studios, and that was wonderful to be able to work with people in 3D. So that was great.
Your voice work is actually really extensive. I was looking at all the many things that you've done and continue to do. How did you decide to get into voice work?
I don't know, really. It's like the rest of my career. I've never really decided anything. It just seems to have kind of happened. I think it must have been about, gosh, not long after I stopped doing Doctor Who. And I started getting asked to do bits of voiceovers and stuff. And then I can't remember how it came about, but I started doing English language stuff, which I love. There's a group of fabulous actors who you just get given the script. You read the, it's all those tapes for people who are learning English abroad. And I love doing those. So I can be playing, I don't know why I get cast as Australians and Kiwis. You know, I'm sure if you don't ask me to do my accent, please. It's sort of like we call it, like we do voiceover Northern and voiceover Australian, you know, so very, very broad. But that's really good fun. So that I started doing that, and I got myself a voice agent, and I just, you know, went from there really. And then I started being asked to do audiobooks, mainly children's audiobooks at first, because that was my audience really. And now I do all sorts, particularly science fiction this year actually, which has been amazing because that's not a genre that I read myself for pleasure. You know, I'm a sort of more of a, I don't know, classic novels and if I'm going to read anything. And so actually for me, it's been brilliant to broaden my horizons in what I read. So it's great.
I was going to say, are you enjoying reading science fiction and things that you wouldn't choose to read?
I am. Yeah, I really am. There was a book I read last year by a wonderful science fiction writer called Adrian Tchaikovsky, and I'm doing another one of his as well. And that was, I mean, just, I'm amazed by the extent of the imagination and the kind of, I don't know, the intelligence of the writers, you know, to be referencing all sorts of different genres and stories and history, and unbelievable, yeah, and creating new worlds, really.
I do want to chat with you a bit later about your book and how you did the audio recording for us, but before that, I'd just like to go way back in terms of when did you decide to go into acting? What was the steps in terms of that sort of choice? I assume as a child, where did that decision come from?
Yeah, I mean, again, I don't think it was really a decision. I think it's something that almost sort of landed on me. I can't remember not having wanted to be an actor of some kind. And when I was really small, I used to make up plays and make all the children in the neighbourhood be in my plays. I always had to be the star, and I told everybody what to do, and I wrote the scripts. So yes, a sort of a dictator from an early age. But actually I don't know where it came from, because none of my family were theatrical or in the business. And I was actually a very shy child, believe it or not. But somehow, I don't know, I felt very comfortable in being other people. I was very small. When I was very small, I used to watch Gerry Anderson series, Thunderbirds. I don't know whether that ever came to Australia.
Every morning.
Oh, great. Well, I was obsessed with that. And I actually thought I was Scott Tracy, the pilot of Thunderbird One. And my mum made me a little outfit with the hat and the sash and everything. And I wouldn't answer to any other name. And then before that, at a very early age, in fact, I was reading, I found some letters that my grandmother had written to my mother, which are absolutely wonderful, treasure trove to find. And one of them describes a holiday that I'd been to stay with her. And she said, Sophie's been watching Wimbledon. I think I must have been about 3 or 4 years old. Sophie's been watching Wimbledon. She's very taken by this player called Richie. And apparently I came down the next morning for breakfast wearing like a what I thought a Wimbledon player would wear. I think it was shorts and a shirt and a tie. And I had a cap on. And I refused to let go of this tennis racket. And everybody had to call me Richie. I wouldn't answer to anything else. So I think role play was in me from a very early age.
Wasn't Miss Penelope that you are linked towards? No. There was the power position of the pilot.
It's funny, isn't it? I never identified with Lady Penelope. I was always a tomboy, so I thought of myself as a boy until I was a teenager, where I suddenly discovered boys, and then things changed. But yeah, up until then, I identified far more with male figures than with female. I mean, I guess it was something to do with the fact that there weren't that many strong, tough female figures to identify with on TV at that time. Lady Penelope just, I mean, I think I probably looked at myself wearing trousers and, you know, a bit of a mess and running around and
having fun.
And I didn't identify with this incredibly smart woman wearing beautiful puppet wearing beautiful lipstick and, you know, with hardly a hair out of place. So yeah.
Doctor Who, Colditz.
You see, there's nothing to worry about.
Ace, we don't know what's out there.
It's a courtyard, big buildings all around us. Some grass over there. I can't make out much. It's getting dark.
I've just realised where we are, Ace.
What's the problem?
No time to explain. Come on.
But we haven't even been shot at yet.
It's only a matter of time, I assure you. Run!
Ah! Doctor!
You are Britishers?
Yeah, that's right. Nazis again. I can't stand Nazis.
You will consider yourself my prisoners. For you, the war is over.
It's a girl, isn't it? It can't be, are you sure?
It jolly well is, you know. It's a girl.
Hey, Kurtz, found yourself a girlfriend?
We will learn everything about you in time, Fräulein Ace, starting with your real name.
I suppose you're going to get your jackbooted friend here to make me talk, are you? Well, don't bother.
It is pointless trying to keep your secrets from us. We shall learn them all eventually.
Our concern is appreciated, Captain, but unnecessary.
This is Colditz Castle, right? There must be 101 ways to escape from here. That's what it's famous for.
Famous? I don't know about that. Well, if you know as much as you claim, then you'll know that this is the escapers' prison.
Right!
I mean, it's where they put those officers who've escaped from other camps. This is the most secure prison in Germany.
So how did you end up in Doctor Who? How did that step come? Was that your first acting job?
No, it wasn't my first acting job. I went to university and did a drama degree. And I think my father was hoping that I'd sort of have it knocked out of me there and I would go into advertising like he did. But actually, by the time I finished university, I'd just been in so many plays and was even more convinced that this was my profession. So when I left, I worked in various theatre companies, a lot of children's theatre, a lot of musical children's theatre, so a lot of singing and different characters and wonderful. And then I got into musicals, actually. So I was in a production of Fiddler on the Roof, which is a wonderful musical, back up in Manchester at the Opera House there with Topol, who played Tevye in the film, which was amazing. I was in the back row of the chorus. And my agent sent me a message to say I had an audition for 3 episodes of Doctor Who. They were looking for somebody who could ride a motorbike. And I'd learnt to ride a motorbike. So there I went. I went off down to London and did an audition. And in those days, you did a piece from a play. So I did something from a wonderful play called Daisy Pulls It Off, playing a young girl. But I knew that they wanted somebody that looked young for their age, because I was 24 at the time, but I knew that they'd said that they were looking for somebody who looked 16. And so I wore this kind of, you know, cute little dress and a little hat. Not that Ace would have gone anywhere near that. But anyway, I got on very well with the director and we had a really good chat and I did my piece. And then I went back off to Manchester. I'd never even had a TV audition before. I'd never been in front of a camera or anything. And then 2 weeks later, I got a recall, went down to London again, and I met John Nathan Turner, the producer. And he said to me, oh, we'll read this piece again. I was in there for about 10 minutes, I think, not more. And then I thought, oh, well, that's it. Won't hear anything more about that. Because, of course, as an actor, you go up for loads of auditions and you never hear from anyone again for most of the time. But anyway, I arrived at the theatre one evening and there were messages for me all over the notice board at the stage door saying, Sophie, call your agent. Sophie, call your agent. But it was gone. It was past time to get ready for the show by that time. So I got my costume on, did the first number, went on stage. And then there was no mobile. We didn't have mobiles in those days, believe it or not. Unbelievable, isn't it? So we all queued up at this phone box at the stage door when we wanted to ring people. And I knew I had a great big gap between tradition and the next number. So I thought, I'll ring her then. So I stood in the queue with my 10p pieces and put them in the phone, rang my agent. And she said, where have you been all day? I've been trying to get in touch with you. And I said, oh, I've just been out and about shopping. You know, why? What is it? She said, they want you for the 3 episodes of Doctor Who, but it's a lot more complicated than that. I'll call you back. Give me your number. So I put the phone down. I thought I couldn't sort of process it. She rang back and she said, they not only do they want you for these 3 episodes, but they're asking if you're interested in perhaps being the new Doctor Who assistant. And I mean, I was just like, you could have knocked me over. It was just, I'd had no screen test. I'd had these 2 brief auditions. You know, I mean, it was an absolute miracle. And I said, yes, of course. I put the phone down and I walked out of the phone box. And the next person in the queue behind me was the guy who played the rabbi in our production, wonderful white shock of hair and lovely, lovely man called John Scott Martin. And he had been the insides of Daleks and Zabies and all sorts for years. And we'd sort of taken the mickey out of him because, you know, we thought, oh, he's in Doctor Who. Anyway, I said to him, John, I got the part. And it was amazing. He reached into his pocket of his costume and he pulled out this postcard and he handed it to me. And it was a BBC publicity postcard with 3 Daleks on it. And I turned it over and it said, Dear Sophie, welcome to the family. You will not be exterminated. And I said, how did you know? And he said, I don't know. He said, I just had a feeling about it. And he'd been carrying this card around with him. It was absolutely extraordinary. And then the very next scene was the gossip scene. And so I kind of walked on stage with my fellow chorus members. And the lines were, you know, this sort of rhubarb. Have you heard? Have you heard? Have you heard? Seitel's got a new sewing machine, you know, da 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 da. Anyway, this performance is, have you heard? Have you heard? Sophie's got the part in Doctor Who and she might be being the Doctor Who assistant. And, you know, everyone was all excited. And then we were on the right-hand side of the stage. And then Topol, as Tevye, came on the other side and he walks downstage and he usually has a little dialogue with somebody in the chorus. And this particular performance, he comes downstage, he stops, he walks over to us, he finds me in the crowd, he throws his arms around me, he says, well done, Sophie, congratulations, and then walks back to the other side of the stage and carries on with the show. It was absolutely extraordinary.
I wonder what the audience made of that.
I know. I mean, how bizarre to be an audience member and what is going on?
So when you'd met John Nathan Turner, what was your first impressions of John?
Oh, well, yeah, I walked into his office and I can just remember a lot of red and orange. He had Dalek curtains and this big desk with John Nathan Turner, a little sort of wooden cutout thing of John Nathan Turner. And then there was a big cabinet on one of the walls. And bear in mind that there wasn't really that much merch at the time for Doctor Who. And he had this big wall cabinet with glass on it and was stuffed full of Doctor Who merchandise from over the years. And right in the centre was a pair of Tom Baker Y-front underpants from the kind of 1970s with brown trim.
I had a pair.
Did you? And Tom's face right on the front.
Yeah.
And they go for £500 on eBay.
Do you remember that?
£500 on eBay.
So, oh, wow. Wow. Amazing. And then this stack of videos on shelves as well, because, of course, you couldn't get hold of Doctor Who videos either in those days. So it was extraordinary. And there was John sitting behind his desk, because you could smoke inside then. And he was, you know, he lit up his cigarette, very theatrical, with this shock of dark curly hair and a Hawaiian shirt, of course, the larger than life character. And he said to me, you know, read this piece. And it was the piece that I'd read for the audition, which was actually Ace's speech from Dragonfire, where she's telling Mel about a bit about her childhood. And, you know, she looks up through the gaps in the clouds and wonders who her mum really was. I don't know. I felt like it was a really wonderful speech anyway. And I felt I could do it justice. And then he gave me a few notes and he asked me if I could read it again. And that was it. Chris Clough popped his head round the door. I think he was rather taken with the fact, was Chris, that my agent had written "has own leathers" on the back of my publicity photo. Because he came and said, you know, oh, this is Sophie. She has her own leathers, you know. And it was like, what? What's that got to do with anything? Anyway, and that was it. I was literally in there for 10 minutes. But it was funny with John because when I actually started working, he was a slightly distant figure at first. You know, he'd come along for the producer runs, as they were called, at the end of each rehearsal week. And he'd walk around with the floor manager and we'd rehearsed all week and then we would do this sort of like a dress run in a way, but without the dress. And he'd walk around again. He wouldn't really say very much. And it really wasn't until probably, because I was quite intimidated by him. You know, he was a very powerful guy. And I didn't really get to know him until Greatest Show in the Galaxy, until we went away on location. And then we kind of had a lot of banter and we were sitting, we went to a pub one night and we sat together on the bar. And I think he couldn't get the measure of me, because there I was, he was used to the world of showbiz and Bonnie Langford and sort of Eyes and Teeth. And there was I, come out of Manchester University, sort of radical, liberal, kind of the anti-Thatcher government, didn't shave my armpits at the time, you know, like, he just didn't get it, you know, it wasn't in his world. And neither did I really get him. I didn't know this world of Eyes and Teeth either. So, you know, it took a little while, but then we became absolutely firm friends. And actually John was, he kind of looked like a flamboyant character, very over the top, but in fact he was really quite, not shy, I wouldn't have said, but reserved, you know. He would be the one who was watching what was going on. Incredibly bright man. And we ended up being firm friends.
I actually had the privilege of meeting John Nathan Turner out here. He came to an event. It was held in a church hall. He made the comment as he walked in. He thought the whole place might explode, him going to a church hall. But he was just bigger than life. And he just held court. But I was always wondering what he was actually like in private. Because as I said, the moment he walked that door, he was performing, and he was a huge performer, and as you said, bigger than life. But I did wonder whether he did have those quieter moments with other people.
Yeah, he definitely had those quieter moments. And he, of course, came with Gary Downey, and Gary would be usually the one in private who would be the doing most of the talking and stuff. And John would be sitting there and make the odd kind of incredibly funny, kind of quite very witty comments or something, or, you know, yeah, they were a good double act.
Doctor Who, The Harvest.
Doctor, Executive Security Officer Garnier regarded me strangely, as if he was afraid of me, as if the sight of me horrified him.
Oh, no, not at all, just healthy respect.
Am I grotesque?
There's a certain degree of tissue swelling and suturing, but that's diminishing daily.
It would be curious if he was afraid of me. That thing that came into this room beside him is far, far more terrifying.
System recognizes Staff Nurse Schofield. Good morning. It is 08:29 a.m., October 12, 2021. You are logged in to begin morning shift.
Thank you, sis.
Do you know a Dorothy McShane works in human resources?
No.
She seems to have an employment record that doesn't quite check out. And as far as I can tell, she's showing an unhealthy interest in C program.
We're investigating St. Gart's Hospital, Mr. Hicks, your place of employment, because we have reason to believe someone there is conducting potentially dangerous experiments with Xenotech.
Which is?
Technology of non-terrestrial origin.
I have never seen London like this.
Well, it'll become a familiar sight. Embankment there, Big Ben, and the Museum of Parliament.
You mistake me, Doctor. I mean, I have never seen anything like this. I have never seen in this way before. Shape, color, perspective and dimension. The resolution so bright, unfiltered, unenhanced.
I'm glad you're pleased. Seeing the world through new eyes. You are pleased, aren't you?
Yes, Doctor. I think that is how I feel.
Now, you said before when you went for the role, you were going for the motorcycle person. So that was actually a different story. You ended up changing stories. So how did that, do you know how that happened?
Well, they were casting for a potential new companion. And they were looking at all, you know, if you notice in Sylvester's first season in Paradise Towers, for example, there were the Kangs, you know, and then there was Ray in Delta and the Bannermen. And that's exactly, they put me up for Ray. But then I think as soon as they met me, as soon as Chris met me, because he was directing both those stories, I think they just realised I'd make a good ace, you know. I was a bit confused when I got the script of Dragonfire because I thought, where's the motorbike? And I never got to ride one.
It is interesting. I mean, you had your own leathers. You would have been a tough motorcycle, but the Ray that they cast ended up being very feminine, and she may have been a motorcycle, but there was nothing else tough about her. Ace was all in there fighting.
Yes. Yeah. Ace is a very different character. Yeah. That's
so did you know before filming whether you were going to be the companion, or was it only after both shows were basically in the can?
Well, what happened was after the first week of rehearsals, because, of course, we had this luxury of rehearsing, which was amazing. Funnily enough, Tony Selby kept saying, he said, oh, Ace would make such a good companion. Oh, yeah, I think Ace would be really great. And I was a bit sort of like, because I was sworn to secrecy, of course. And I was thinking, well, hang on a minute. Bonnie hasn't left yet, you know, because she hadn't said whether she was going or staying, I don't think. Although, funny, talking to her now, she said she didn't think there was an option. She just thought that you just did however many stories and that was it. But I think she was fine about going. But they hadn't quite finalized it that first week. So I had to keep quiet. And of course, they didn't know if I'd get on with Sylvester or what we'd be like together. And I think after that first week, everyone just went, oh, yeah, because after the then we got into studio. And after the first day, I remember walking out for the first time in front of the camera in this massive studio with these great big screens hanging around the ceiling. And the camera just looked me up and down like this and then could see my face massive on these screens. And everyone was just sort of looking at the screens. They weren't looking at me going, yeah. It's so funny, like being judged like by everybody there. It was quite funny, really. And after that first day's filming, everybody went and they said, Sophie, could you stay for a minute? And so I stayed on the set and I could hear this cling, 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 cling as John came down the metal steps at the side of the studio from the gallery. And he came towards me and lit up and he said, well, darling, he said, we're on if you're on. And I took that to mean, right, it's the goer. and then very soon after that, they had to obviously hastily write this exit scene. And Sylvester was just going to be, because originally it was written that Ace would go off with Glitz and obviously Mel would stay with the Doctor. So they had to hastily write, because Sylvester said, I can't just say bye. And she's gone. You know, I've been with her for all this time. And then that's when Andrew Cartmell and Ian Briggs got together in the, literally in the tea bar outside the studio and came up with that beautiful last scene for them, which was, it was based on the screen test that Sylvester had done with Janet Fielding for his screen test. It was a goodbye to a companion, and he really had loved that. So he said, I want something like that.
So you say you didn't do a screen test. So when did you first meet Sylvester, and what input did he have in terms of you two working together?
Yeah, I first met him on our first read through. So I arrived at the rehearsal studios in a place called North Acton, and there was this big block of a big sort of tower block, and it had inside had these massive rehearsal spaces. I mean, it was a wonderful place. And I found the Doctor Who room and walked in, and there was this table right across the other side of the room. I walked over to this table, and there's Sylvester and Bonnie, and there's Pat Quinn, and there's Tony Asoba, and there's all these people I'd seen on telly, you know, and there was little me. Nobody knew who I was. And I sat down sort of like behind everybody else, and everyone went round and introduced themselves. Nobody paid me any attention. Anyway, halfway through the script, people started turning around and looking at me, realizing I'd got rather a large part. And in fact, that's what Pat Quinn said to me at the end. She said, oh, darling, you've got a large part, haven't you? Anyway, and at some point then I was introduced to everybody to Sylvester. I can't quite remember, but we did get on like a house on fire straight away. And we found out we had the same birthday and we had very similar-ish background in doing kind of fringe theatre and working men's clubs. And we had the same ideas about politics and the world. And we just hit it off straight away. And he says it's because I'm the only person who laughs at all his jokes.
I'm sure that's not true.
I don't think it's true at all. But I do kind of, I don't know, I do get Sylvester. And he's still one of my very closest friends.
It's interesting that, the next two seasons, in some ways, Ace becomes the lead of the show. The Doctor-companion relationship changes in a way it has never been before, in terms of Ace drives so much plot, so many ideas, so much of the themes that's going to drive the show for the next 2 years. How did they come up with ideas so fast in terms of the following season? Because, I mean, Revelation of the Daleks, it just dives in with the Doctor being more mysterious, more in the background, more empowering the companion, which is wonderful for a young woman to suddenly be seen on screen as the tour de force of what's going on. Do you know what the thinking in the process was behind that? Because the change from male to ace is astronomical in companions. What was Andrew Cartmell's vision or John Nathan Turner's vision? Do you know what was driving that?
I think it literally was Andrew Cartmell. You know, because Mel was a product of a previous script editor, and Andrew came in and he modernized the whole show, really. He brought it up to date. And Ace is very much a product of late 1980s Britain, you know, sort of disenfranchised youth with a chip on her shoulder, you know. And I think Andrew was very much of the mind that the companion should reflect life in some way, not just be something for the dads to look at, or, you know, I mean, that had happened before. And Mel, for goodness sake, she was meant to be a computer programmer from Pease Pottage, wasn't she? And very bright. But unfortunately, the writing didn't ever really reflect that. So I think Andrew just injected the... and he had all new writers as well. So Ben Aronovich, for example, I mean, he was young, new, untried, untested, bouncy, enthusiastic science fiction fan. And he was part of Ace's world, really. I think Ben and I are similar age anyway. And we were all similar ages. So yeah, I think once this character had been born by Ian Briggs and Andrew Cartmell, I think the writers just went, "Oh, I see, we can do this." And then I remember having a meeting with the writers, which was, I don't think that had been done before the next season, so that they could actually sort of meet me and talk about ideas and things. Can't remember what the ideas were. I can remember the meal, but I can't remember what ideas were. And then Sylvester himself, you know, Sylvester wanted to be, he suddenly got halfway through his first season. Ah, okay. This is a character who can be anyone. And I think he got infused by the idea of being a mysterious doctor. And being the one who kind of like is the almost like the puppet master. So he could step back and be a little bit more mysterious. And then Andrew Cartmell and he, I think they came up with this idea of this sort of something is not just a Time Lord. There was this sort of, you know, he was in there at the beginning. We don't quite know who he is yet. And he liked that idea, and he was incredibly generous, really, in allowing Ace to have the stories, you know, like, say, Curse of Fenric and Ghostlight. They're all about Ace. But I think he realised as well that this was giving his Doctor more character and more interesting character to play. So that's how that came about.
Sylvester sometimes says he just didn't want to learn the lines.
Well, there was that too. Yes, instead of saying, "Well, Ace, this is a blah, 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 blah," he'd say, "So, Ace, what can you remember about this? Or what do you think this is?" And then I'd have to come up with all the gobbledygook.
I mean, looking back, lots of people talk about those last 2 years as one of the most creative times in Doctor Who. You were trialing things that hadn't been tried before. You were taking major risks with plots, picking on Thatcherism. I mean, there's an original idea that one show was supposed to be filmed in black and white. In the end, they panicked and didn't do it. Is it partly, do you think, the freedom was there because the BBC had stopped watching and caring? Was it because John Nathan Turner was just totally trusted Andrew Cartmell, or he was just tired? Do you know, what do you think were the factors that actually made those last two seasons so unique?
Yeah, I think a combination of that. You know, John Nathan Turner, he was there because he knew that if he wasn't there, then Doctor Who wouldn't happen. And unfortunately, it was a bit of like shooting himself in the foot, his career in the foot. But he saved Doctor Who, you know, those last, we wouldn't have been there without him. Yeah, and the executives had really just lost interest. They apparently, I found out, or Sylvester was telling me, they weren't even watching the tapes. They didn't, you know, they just didn't care. So it kind of gave a free rein, really, to do whatever they liked. And I think Andrew just sort of, you know, took it on. And Andrew and John were like chalk and cheese, but there was some kind of relationship between them where, you know, they really respected each other. They really knew that the other, they trusted each other. And I think that was it. I think John trusted Andrew with these new writers, and they probably thought, oh, why the hell not? You know, we can experiment here. It's not going to hurt anything. And so sure enough, they did come up with these great, interesting, quite innovative ideas that hadn't been done before.
Coming soon from Big Finish Productions, Doctor Who, Protect and Survive.
Air attack warning. Go to your fallout room or take shelter. Do not panic. Stay calm.
This is not a test.
Ace, they've only gone and started World War III.
Four missiles targeted on military targets within the United Kingdom.
Albert, cup of tea.
Thanks a lot.
What's that?
We're on Earth. That's something to be grateful for.
Come on, let's get some fresh air.
After a nuclear explosion, there will be a cloud of deadly dust called fallout.
Door's bolted. Albert?
It's all right, love. I'm here beside you.
Here it comes!
The radiation from this dust cannot be seen or smelt, but exposure to it can cause sickness and even death.
So the doctor's behind it all.
What do you mean?
Well, who died and put him in charge?
You cannot leave us, Doctor. You cannot.
Enemy missile attack incoming.
Have you no mercy? No compassion? No pity?
I suggest you take cover.
Subscribers get more at bigfinish.com.
So when you finished filming on Ghostlight, which was the last show filmed, what were you expecting to happen next year?
So the following year, I was on what's called an optional contract, which means that they can cancel it if they need to, and I could as well. So like if something had... Because we used to film for 6 months and then 6 months off, and I was lucky enough to have another job I did for the 6 months, which was a children's presenting job in between. But, you know, say I'd got some huge job, I could have got out of it if I'd wanted, not that I'd have wanted to. But that was the expectation that Sylvester and I, and all of us, you know, we were at the wrap party at the end of Ghostlight. It was like, oh yeah, bye, see you next year, you know, see you in April. And then it was not to be. And I was actually rehearsing back at North Acton for this children's show I did. And a call came through to the little office, because again, no mobiles, but there was a phone in the office. And they said, oh, Sophie, it's for you. So I went and got the call, and it was Sylvester. And he'd just found out, and he realised that I didn't know, so he'd called me straight away. And he told me. And it was a complete shock out of the blue, because we'd all expected to just go on. Now, John and latterly Andrew had known, because Andrew had, I think Andrew knew at the end of survival filming, because he'd written that beautiful speech about the tea getting cold. So I think he knew then. John certainly knew throughout Ghostlight, but I mean, thank goodness he didn't tell us then, because it would have completely put a whole downer on the whole shoot. He was holding a lot, really, John. And then I, soon after the call with Sylvester, I had a letter from John And yeah, and it was really sad because, I mean, both Sylvester and I, fortunately, we're so lucky that we have been in kind of pretty much constant work ever since. But there was really nothing like Doctor Who. It was just such a fabulous experience to be filming Doctor Who with that crew and those casts. You know, that everybody was pulling for the best that they could be. The crews loved working on it. The casts all loved working on it. It was like a family. It really was. It was an amazing experience.
Despite there being no Doctor Who on television during the 90s, there was quite a lot of unofficial Doctor Who activity which you were quite involved in. Some titles I can think of off the top of my head. I think More Than a Messiah, you're in that video production. Mind Game trilogy so you've done a few things with Keith Barnfather and still doing even more recently, which I'll probably touch on later. But how did you get into those productions and why did you maintain that interest in the Doctor Who sort of unofficial area?
Well, I think by that time, both Sylvester and I, we'd met the other, you know, cast members. We knew Colin Nicola very well. We knew other people, and we knew the professional, if you like, fans. We knew Keith, we knew Bill Baggs, we knew all sorts of people. We knew, yeah, Nigel Fairs, we knew Gary Russell, and all sorts of people from the conventions that we'd been to, Keith and Nick Briggs. I mean, loads of people who were cutting their teeth on Doctor Who fan stuff. And we thought, why not? You know, we knew Doctor Who fans loved it. We love working. Actors love working. The pay, you know, that's neither here nor there sometimes. But it was fun, and fun to be together and fun to be working. You know, we want to work as actors. And these scripts were good. The crews were, you know, people were learning on the job as well. And that's fun. And we all had such fun together. It was great. More Than a Messiah, you know, that was wonderful working with Colin, just playing a different character, being covered in green makeup and dripped on in Wookiee Hole caves. And then Keith's stuff, you know, the Mind Game. And then, of course, Bill Baggs's the audio stuff. And I remember standing in a basement doing an audio drama written by somebody called Mark Gatiss, you know, who was standing there. And we were all friends by then, and still are. You know, it's the lines got blurred between cast members and, you know, and the fans who were putting on the conventions and doing these amazing productions. And it was fun. That's the main thing. It was fun.
Recently, we had Miles Richardson on the podcast, and he was in Mind Game, wasn't he? So,
yeah.
Do you have any memories of it? Because I think it was that particular performance that Big Finish remembered him from, and he was brought into the Big Finish family later on through that. So, what are your memories of Miles?
Well, Miles, I can't quite remember the chronology. I think before Mind Game, even Bill Baggs had done an audio with Miles and me. And I knew, I can't remember how it all came about, but I knew this wonderful actress, Bev Cressman, who was also in Keith's productions. And she was at the time married to Miles. And Bev and I got on really well. And I met Miles through her, I think. And Miles is he's just a great character, wonderful actor. And it was wonderful working with him. I remember working on particularly on the Bill Baggs audio, because it was great. When you work with a really good actor, it ups your own game, you know, And Miles was that really good actor. So, and then Mind Game, again, he just was that part, wasn't he? I mean, you know, he was just so brilliant. And he's fun and irreverent and naughty and great to be with. Yeah.
It speaks so well while he does it.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You kind of go, did he really say that? His plummy tones.
So you then went on to do all kinds of kids' programs. I was looking through the list of kids' stuff you've done and lots of stuff out here, the Bob the Builder and all kinds of roles. Was it, once again, how did you start developing all those voices? Was it just you just started working on it, or you've been playing around with voices for a long time?
Oh, yeah, for years. I mean, right from when I was a kid, my brother and I used to give our dolls and our toys voices, and we used to make up adventures for them. So my brother, who's also very good at silly voices and accents and stuff, we'd always play around with voices, and I love different accents. I love different voices. And so I just picked them up along the way. And I've used them ever since. So, yeah, I remember a memo went round at the BBC apparently saying, anybody think of an actress who could do a baby Mexican gerbil? And apparently four or five people got back and said Sophie Aldred. So that was for a show called El Nombre, which is a sort of kids' maths program. And then in Corners as well, that I was doing concurrently with Doctor Who, that involved being characters as well. It was a presenting job, but also we'd explain things using different characters. So that was great fun. Loads of them. I've always loved it.
Have you ever got together with Katie Manning and had a voice off?
Oh, yes. Well, the Iris Wild Time stuff for Big Finish, of course. I did one of those with her, and it happened to be I was playing an alien cow villainess. And I was thinking, now, what voice shall I do for this? And it happened to be Margaret Thatcher's funeral that day. I have brought her up a lot, haven't I, poor Margaret Thatcher? Anyway,
good reason.
It was her funeral that day, and I thought, I know who I'll do. So that was my homage, or rather not homage. Homage.
The cow, Margaret Thatcher. Yeah.
As a space cow, yeah.
Now, in 1999, you did your first Big Finish production, which was actually Bernie Summerfield, Beyond the Sun. So how did you come to work for Big Finish? Was it just, what were you expecting, and how did it happen?
Yes, it was a bit of a segue from the Bill Bagg stuff, because Bill had shot himself in the foot because he was doing all this Professor and Ace stuff. And then the BBC said, that looks remarkably like Doctor Who and Ace, the Professor and Ace. And he just thought, oh, okay, fair enough. It's a fair cop. But then Jason Haigh-Ellery thought, hang on a minute. And he was a wonderful businessman, brilliant entrepreneur. And he went to the BBC and said, by the way, you're not doing anything with the license. Can I have the license to do BBC audios? And they said, yeah, all right. And Big Finish was born. And then we started doing them. And it was great. We used to record them initially in a studio in Fulham, in a garage, with another guy, Daniel Cohen, who was a fan. It was his studio, I think, or he'd certainly had some big hand in this studio. And again, it was all friends of friends and, you know, great fun doing them all together. And we recorded a lot there. And then we went to the Moat Studios in Brixton at first, it was. And then Toby moved over to Westbourne Grove, and we're still there. Long may they continue. And now we're in cupboards and attics and all sorts of strange places in our houses, remotely recording them.
I don't think it was particularly a break from seeing Sylvester, was it? Because you've continued having a strong relationship with him all the way, haven't you?
Yeah, so definitely.
So what was it like going back to playing Ace after a 10-year break or so?
Do you know, it was funny because we didn't, it's whenever we go back to playing the Doctor and Ace, it's just like, it feels like just we put on the jacket, he puts on his jacket or his hat and off we go. You know, it's sort of, I think it's so ingrained really over this time. It's not difficult to, it all comes from the script anyway. So people often say to me, you know, oh, there's often in Big Finish, there's young Ace, there's older Ace, there's, how do you know which Ace it is? Well, it comes from the script, as with any character, really. It's sort of all there in the page. And these writers are brilliant, you know. They're just so, they know the character almost as well as I do, you know. So it's never been an issue, really. I've never gone, oh, now, how did Ace sound again? I don't know. Maybe she's, somebody once asked me at a convention, how much of you is Ace now? And how much of Ace is you? And it's like, oh, wow, that's really interesting because, you know, she's been with me for all these years. I wonder who I'd be if I hadn't played Ace. And it was funny because my mum said when she first saw me in Dragonfly, she said, yes, I recognise that expression, she said. The raise of the eye, you know, the tutting.
Listen to me. There are things in here with us that are not of this planet.
Back, they're here for me.
Coming soon from Big Finish Productions, Doctor Who, Nightshade.
We're missing something. What is it? I see the creature from my old series. Poor Lawrence believed that the ghost of his late brother appeared to him. Your security guard and Jack Prado. What did they see?
What's that?
Oh. Oh. Bob! Is that you?
Ace, what the hell is that?
I don't know, but we need to move now!
Hurry, Miss Mason!
We are being bombarded by data from space. Maybe it's...
Invaders from Mars. That's your province, not mine. At least in the real world.
Look at all that energy pouring from it. What do you need?
Need.
Yes, we've established that. What is it that you need?
Oh, something's breaking through the wall.
Son, I think we better get out of here, sharp.
Oh.
Dear God! You see, it's them! Into the corridor! Run! Now!
Looks like there's a storm coming.
Big Finish. We love stories.
Grandfather! I'm curious about what the secret is, because you and Sylvester in particular, out of everyone who works for Big Finish, you two, over, you've been there for 20 years now, and even longer if you count the TV Doctor Who as well, but your voices have never changed, whereas everyone else seems to age a little, and you can tell that aging process over the years. But what's your secret? Genes?
I think it's funny. I do, when I'm playing young Ace, I do have to sort of pitch up a little bit. And I always had quite a deep voice anyway. I think that helped. But I don't know. I don't know what it is. It's, I keep myself fit. I don't know whether that's anything to do with it. Keep working, keep laughing. But no, I have noticed changes. But, I don't know. I think playing Ace, I can get into her and be her young self.
According to the Big Finish catalogue, you've done about 100 productions for them.
Oh, my goodness.
Over 20 years. So I'm expecting you can't name all of them or any of them. Does it just feel like a blur 20 years in terms of going to studio, meeting new actors? Is there stuff that stands out in particular that you've done over 20 years?
Yeah, there are some scripts which I stand out. There's, I think there was one, there's the hex stuff I particularly enjoyed doing. Funnily enough, the one you've got behind you there, Protect and Survive, I remember that one because I thought to myself, gosh, that would be a really good one to have. You could do that as a theatre piece.
Yes, it's so bleak though, but yes.
Yeah, and it is, I love the bleakness of it. In fact, all those ones you've got behind you, there's Colditz, which was standout because I met a certain actor called David Tennant there, who even before he was well known, walked into the room and made me go a bit weak in the knees. And then there's...
And you've just been working with him again.
Yes, I have. Yeah, that was really great to do that. I'm so glad we got to work together at last. That was brilliant as him as the Doctor. It was brilliant. Yeah, there's loads. There's Afterlife. I particularly liked that one. I think it's anything where I get to kind of do a full range of emotion. I also loved the 8th of March, the stuff that we did for Women's Day. There was a brilliant story for that. I really enjoyed that one. So, yeah, I mean, there are some standout moments. And then the actors, of course, that you meet there are just amazing, you know, just really... lovely to work with people like Clive Mantle and, oh, just too many to mention, really.
Do you usually know who you're going to work with before you get in there, or is it just arriving at the green room and seeing who's there?
Sometimes we do, and most of the time we don't. Yeah, so it's lovely because you get to the green room and for Sylvester particularly, he'll suddenly go, oh, I haven't seen you for years and years, you know? And they're all lovely people and they're all... we have to warn them not to eat too much during the morning. Don't have that donut because you're going to have an amazing lunch. And they go, huh? And we go, you wait and see. And they think, because it's a very nondescript little green room, you know. And then Toby goes off into this tiny little kitchen and these smells start coming out. And then he opens the door and everyone goes in and the visiting actors go, oh my God. And it's like all their dreams come true, you know, because as an actor, you just want to know where you're going to get your next meal, you know.
In a couple of days, we're actually going to be speaking with Lisa Bauman. So is there anything that you'd like to pass on to her?
Yes, I miss her. We've done such a lot together over the years and had such a... Whenever we see each other, we always have such a good catch up, and we've done some funny stuff together. And it's always just so great to work with somebody so intelligent and thoughtful as well. Yeah, she's taken my headshots. We've just been through life together, you know. It's really good to have a friend like that.
The monthly range came to an end. This month, it was the final monthly release. Your last one was The Old Grey Man of the Mountain.
Mm.
What are your feelings about the end of the monthly range? Do you know what's coming next? Because we're waiting for the reveal. Don't tell us, of course.
I'm always last to know. I have absolutely no idea. No, I'll get a message from David or Nick or somebody and they'll say, can we book you for so-and-so? I'll go, yep, sure. And then I walk in, it's like, oh, okay, I'm doing that now.
So you've got the David Tennant coming up, the old companion's new doctor thing. Do you have much more in the can?
I don't know. I don't think I do, actually. It's time I had another message from them, I think.
So At Childhood's End, your first novel, how did that come about?
Well, it was actually, I got an email or a call from Steve Cole. And Steve Cole, I did Short Tricks with years ago, and he did a lot for BBC Books. He's a wonderful writer in his own right. He's written, he's most famous for a children's range of books called It's All Dinosaurs in Space. And he made his name doing that in recent years. But he's a lovely guy, and it was great to hear from him. And he just said, did you know Tom Baker did this thing called Scratch Man a few years ago? It's an idea that he came up with years ago and he never got around to doing it. You're next. They've asked at Penguin Random House if you'd like to write a novel. And I was like, what? And he said, oh, don't worry, because Mike and I will help you, Mike Tucker. And Mike, I did my previous book with, Ace, the Inside Story of an End at the End of an Era. And also he was in visual effects. He's really, really good mate of mine and brilliant writer as well of Doctor Who stuff and all sorts. And I thought, well, if I'm going to be writing a book, then there's nobody's company who I'd rather have. And we got together, we had a meeting, we sort of went through some ideas, and I just filmed the trailer for the season 26 Blu-ray. So I had a very clear idea of who Ace is now, of Dorothy and her penthouse apartment and overlooking tower, the Tower of London. And I thought, yeah, that's what I want to do. I wanted her to have lots of tech. I can't remember who came up with the idea of her having a sort of like a bat cave and
squib thing,
and a squidget and all that. And then we all got to work, and we first of all came the sort of the short synopsis, and then the longer synopsis, and then the scenes. And I really wanted to focus on the meeting of the 13th Doctor and Ace. I thought that would be what the fans would really want to see. And we did a few, and I also was really keen on tying up all the ends, because people often say to me, how come Ace has got so many different timelines? You know, she dies here, she goes off there, she does this here, she goes off to Gallifrey there, she da da da. And I thought, right, let's find some way of explaining all that. And I hope we did.
So was the 13th Doctor your call, or was that Steve Cole who wanted?
No, that was Penguin Random House. That was the spec, was that it was a Doctor Who book. It's meant to be a 13th Doctor book. I can't believe how they let us get away with having so much of the first bit of the book being without the 13th Doctor.
Well, you know, I just downloaded it on audio, so, and just started listening to it without. I don't read synopses. I don't read any reviews before I listen to something. I like to always hit it fresh. And so when the 13th Doctor turned up, I was quite surprised.
Wow, great.
Well, in my head, it was going to be just an Ace story.
Yes.
And certainly the first quarter, well, third quarter, is just Ace and her life. And I listened to it. I didn't read it because I wanted to listen to it. Just the way you captured her voice, but the mature voice of Ace, it felt so her.
Thank you.
Yeah, so it was wonderful. So as I said, when the 13th Doctor turned up, once again, when you, so how much of is you, how much is, who wrote the book in terms of how much of collegial is it?
It's so funny. We can't tell anymore. You know, you can't point at one particular point. It was a true collaboration. And I'm so grateful for that, because I would never be able to sit down and write a book on my own. That's for sure. I'd find it depressing and boring, and I like to be with other people. So to be doing it in this collaborative way was perfect for me.
Yeah. So in terms of actually, can I ask you about doing an audiobook then? Because when you read it, yes, it's wonderful reading, and there's a few times I can't tell it's you. You're playing a few characters, and the voice is just sort of great, and you're having a conversation with yourself. There's a time early on, where you're having a conversation with your best friend, Shana, I forget what her name is.
Oh, Chantel, yeah.
Chantel, and it's backwards and forth, and I was just lost in this two-hander conversation.
Wow.
Thinking, well, that's you, which was great. But you also got Yaz's and the 13th Doctor's voices really accurately. Did you listen to a lot of material to try and get their voices so well?
I watched the show, and I kind of... I don't know. I think what's different, you see, is that it's much easier for a woman to get a woman's voice. So for me to do a Tom Baker or a Sylvester, I find very hard to do. And thank goodness, so does top impressionist John Culshaw, so I'm not alone. But for a woman to do a woman's voice is much easier. So I don't know. I think also you kind of inhabit when you know the character, and I have watched the 13th Doctor most of the stories, so you kind of you get to know who the character is, and somehow that helps as well.
Once again, I really appreciate what you did with Yaz. I think Yaz has been underserved on the TV show, and suddenly she was given a prominence and power like I think Ace had. So I was wondering. Yeah,
I love the character of Yaz, and I think she deserves to have more. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and once again, you got her voice. The intonation you got of her, some of her words and accents was really, yeah, as I said.
Oh, thank you.
I've been listening and lost to it. So more books on the horizon? You got something else planned?
I've got nothing planned, no. It was a kind of a labour of love, that one. And, you know, maybe in the future, but it's much, much easier to read them than to write them, that's for sure.
So we don't know what's coming next for Ace, but there's more on track. We're just waiting to see what it is.
Yes. Gosh, it's funny being an actor, because you never know what's going to happen next. You hope something will happen, but you never quite know what it is.
Great. Well, listen, thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
As she stepped through into the space beyond, three startled faces turned to look at her. Two of them, a man and a woman, appeared to be in their late teens, while the third was an older, grey-haired man in a smart leather jacket. But it was what stood beside them that took Dorothy's full attention and almost took her breath away. It was a battered blue police box. The TARDIS. Unashamedly incongruous, and possibly the most beautiful thing Dorothy had ever seen. The seconds passed, and as the breath returned to her body, she turned to the boy. "Where is he?" The boy stared at her in bemusement. "Where's who?" "Are you one of the crew here?" the girl asked. Impatient now, Dorothy took a step towards the TARDIS, bellowing through the doors. "Oi! Professor! Come on out!" The older man stepped across the doors, blocking her. "Believe me, love. There's no one called the Professor in there." "They know me as the Doctor." Dorothy turned at the sound of the warm northern tones to see a tall, slim blonde woman in a long grey coat standing inside the door. Her grin was as bright as the stripes of colour across her top, and it was a smile of recognition. Dorothy, for reasons she couldn't comprehend, felt a wave of emotion. "Who are you?" she demanded. "It's me, Ace. Different body, but the same brilliant brain and much better hair." "You're the Professor?" Dorothy could barely bring herself to believe it. "No way! Come on! Regeneration, you remember? When a Time Lord's body gets old or damaged, yada yada." Dorothy could feel the rational part of her brain dismissing what she was hearing, and yet there was something so familiar about the woman in front of her. She could feel her eyes beginning to blur with angry tears. "Prove it! If you're the Professor, prove it!" "All right. You support Charlton Athletic because your favourite uncle lived in Plumstead. You love motorbikes, although I never let you ride one. You taught yourself to speak proper because you wanted to sound like a Blue Peter presenter. You can't see a Dalek without feeling a twitch in your baseball bat hand. You learn to love jazz, and you think being tall is overrated. Oh, and you hate clowns." "She sounds pretty awesome," said the boy, smiling, while the girl and the older man swapped baffled looks. "She is." The Doctor's grin grew wider. "It's good to see you again, Ace." Dorothy felt the warm rush of surrender. "Blimey, Professor! It really is you!"
So there we go, Philip. Lovely chat with Sophie Aldred. Thanks for organising that. It was a privilege and a pleasure.
Yeah, she's a real joy, isn't she? And just her love of life and her love of what she does, it's marvellous.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Let's go straight in some recommendations for this time, shall we?
Okay. I wonder whose turn it might be first.
Actually, no. Hang on. I think it might be... No, it's your turn.
Okay, then. I'll go first. We did chat a bit with Sophie about her first book. Well, it's not her first book, but I guess it's her first novel, At Childhood's End. So I'm actually going to recommend that. An audio book. So I downloaded the book a couple of weeks ago. It's a great listen to. It's long because it's a full-length novel. And to be perfectly honest, I hadn't... people know me by now. I don't read blurbs. I don't read reviews. I just switched something on. And I just thought it was an ace story. I was not expecting the 13th Doctor to turn up. It was a bit of a surprise, I guess. I mean, I was kind of aware that the 13th Doctor was around. But when you actually start the book and Sophie starts reading, it's all about Dorothy and Ace, you just don't realise the 13th Doctor's going to turn up. And for the first quarter or so, it's just an Ace story. And it's a pretty exciting, great Ace story with a bit of romance, a bit of past relationships. There's some great stuff in it. Sophie reads it so well. Her vocal talents are astounding. And there are times she's having a conversation that I forget that that's what's going on. So, yeah, can't recommend more strongly. At Childhood's End, get the audiobook. Well, Dwayne, that's my pick for the week. What about you? What have you been listening to?
Well, I would like to recommend something that was released last month. We're in May now. Can you believe it is May? Earlier in April, The Lone Centurion was released. So, I was not sure what to expect out of that. I wasn't sure. I thought there might be a level of humour in there, and there was. Did it go down some avenues that I didn't expect? Yes, it did. But one episode in particular on that box set, and I recommend the whole box set of The Lone Centurion, but episode two was a big standout for me called The Unwilling Assassin. I really loved that one. It was some real laugh-out-loud stuff. I thought Arthur Darvill was just superb with his comic timing in that. And a newish writer. I don't think she's written anything else at this stage. Sarah Ward. I know she's got some more things coming up, but I was really impressed with her as one of the newer writers for Big Finish. And I believe that Sarah is one to watch. So I think, down the track, there's more. I can't remember what's been announced that she's actually writing for, but there is more stuff from Sarah coming out this year. So look out for that. And my recommendation, The Lone Centurion. There you go. Get it. What do you think of that?
Fabulous choice. It was interesting. I finished listening to the Master Stories, and which were quite dark, great, but I had really enjoyed them. And then immediately put on Lone Centurion, and the total change of tone
just was, a slight change.
It was total swing left turn, but it was wonderful, and I just smiled through the whole thing. Arthur Darvill is brilliant. I think he would be my favourite companion out of the Matt Smith era, just because Rory's just so gorgeous and so kind and so sacrificial. And, it was just hearing him trying to do all the things he's doing in that box set. It is just charming. Yeah, so I'm really looking forward to what's to come. And we're coming forward a couple of centuries.
There was a trailer at the end, and I was a little bit surprised that they're going to be jumping forward such a long way. Fascinated to see where they go next. Loving that one.
Got 2,000 years. They can't take too much time to do 2,000 years.
Well... We could have a box set for each century, couldn't we?
Perhaps.
All right. So that'll do us for tonight. It's been a pleasure listening to or re-listening to Sophie's interview. We hope you enjoyed that too. So until next time, it's goodbye from Philip.
It is goodbye from me, and it's goodbye from Dwayne.
Catch you later.
You have been listening to The Sirens of Audio, episode 56. Wicked! With our special guest, Sophie Aldred, and your hosts, Philip Edney and Dwayne Bunny. Theme music by the Jackpot Golden Boys. Email us at sirensofaudio@gmail.com. And check out our website, sirensofaudio.com, for links to all our podcast and social media locations. Don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel and tell as many people about the podcast as you think will get some enjoyment from it. Thank you for that. And if you're the king of drama queens and you're getting jack of it, throw on some audio drama featuring the Seventh Doctor and Ace, unless, of course, you have a full house and you hear someone in the bathroom having a flush, and I'll stop right there. Just listen to audio drama, okay? Because audio drama is so cool.